Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Mbuga. This evening we'll talk about Islamist extremist attacks in Nigeria and Kenya. And with us tonight is joining us from Kisumu is Fred Omolo. Fred is works at the Kenyan newspaper, The Standard. Good evening, Fred.
Good evening, Douglas.
How is Kisumu?
Yeah, Kisumu is okay. Very erratic weather, but we are doing fine.
That's very good. And joining us momentarily will be my colleague, Mustafa Aliyu of VOA's Hausa Service. Mustafa will be joining us in a moment. And as I said, our topic tonight is going to be the Islamic extremist attacks in Nigeria and Kenya. In Nigeria, Boko Haram has waged a 5-year insurgency to create an Islamic State, establishing bases along Nigeria's border with Cameroon and Chad. Boko Haram is a militant Islamist movement based in northeast Nigeria. In Kenya, although Al-Shabaab is based in Somalia, the group has stepped up its campaign in Kenya since 2011. When Kenya sent troops across the border to help battle the militants. Al-Shabaab is also an extremist, jihadist terrorist group based in Somalia. Let me begin here in studio with my colleague who has just joined me here, Mustafa Aliyu of VOA's Hausa Service. First of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Douglas.
Yes, just in case you missed my introduction, I was talking comparing the Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram in Nigeria. Boko Haram has killed more than 5,000 civilians between July 2009 and June 2014, mm-hmm. including at least 2,000 in the first half of this year alone. Can anybody ignore Boko Haram now in Nigeria?
You know, Douglas, the big difference not only between Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab is that the difference between Boko Haram and any other ideological organization is that at least you have a good idea of what those other organizations are fighting for.
That's right.
In the case of Boko Haram, it is supposed to be an Islamic militant group. Mm. But you noted that most of its victims have been Muslims themselves.
Even recently, they killed people in a mosque.
In Kano, they killed over 200 people who were praying on Friday, which is the most important Islamically important date for Muslims, because that is when they congregate. Mm. How would you say Allahu Akbar and then keep people who are also saying the same thing at the same time? They kill Muslims, they kill Christians. In the case of Al-Shabaab, at least you know it is fighting governments in Kenya and in Somalia. Mm. Same thing with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is fighting the Western nations. Mm. Nobody still, as of now, understands what Boko Haram is fighting against. Mm. Of course, they claim they want to establish an Islamic caliphate, but the region in which they are staging these militant attacks is Muslims are the majority in Yobe, in Borno, in Adamawa. Right. Mm. So you don't know what these people are fighting for. And also the uniqueness of the situation, of the fact that they are only fighting in the northern part of Nigeria, while the rest of Nigeria is living peacefully and coexisting peacefully between Muslims and non-Muslims. That is the big difference between Boko Haram and any other organization, not just Al-Shabaab.
I see. Fred, for Al-Shabaab, as my colleague here points out, Al-Shabaab wants Kenya out of Somalia. And you think they are beginning to make an impact now, don't you think so?
Yes, it's true. They're making an impact. They're really making an impact. Kenya went into Somalia in late 2011. And the reason that the Kenya Defense Forces, the military here, deployed into Somalia at that time was because Al-Shabaab started conducting cross-border attacks. They kidnapped a number of tourists, and they moved as far as Lamu, which is quite close to the Somalian border, but is also quite deep in Kenya, because to reach Lamu, you have to go beyond the northeastern area where there's a huge population of Muslims and a huge population of Kenyan Somalis, right? But I tend to think that this is only an excuse, because even before Kenya invaded Somalia in 2011, they were already conducting those attacks, they were already infiltrating, they were already trying to get Kenyan identification documents so that they can have free and safe movement. They were using the Kismayu, Mandera, Garissa, Nairobi corridor, to launder a lot of money, to transport a lot of illegal charcoal and sugar. But there's another development that has happened just today, which maybe I can share with you. Transparency International has just released its index of corrupt countries and non-corrupt countries. And if you look at that list, the most corrupt countries in Africa has the group with the most terrorist attacks. For example, you have Uganda in there, you have Kenya, you have Nigeria in there. All these corrupt countries, they rank in the top 15 of the most corrupt states within Africa. You look at the least corrupt countries in Africa, the top 15 also have the least amount of terrorist attacks. So you're talking about Rwanda, you're talking about Tanzania, Botswana, and such countries. So after looking at this thing today, I was reading an assessment from one of the leading journalists in East Africa. He's called Charles Onyango Obbo. And Charles Onyango Obbo is of the idea that Islamic extremism within Africa is more a function of corruption. It's more a function of economic disparities between the rich and the poor. When you have a corrupt country, then anyone can come to the border, pay the cops, pay the immigration officials, move in with whatever they want to move in, whatever weapons they have, and basically organize any kind of terrorism. If you look at the way Al-Shabaab has been recruiting in Kenya over the last 4 or 5 years, let's just say 3 to 4 years, they've been really giving young people the cash incentive. So they find unemployed youths, and these days they look at all communities, they target all kinds of people from ethnicities. They convert them to Islam, and then they take them for training in Somalia. And while they are away, their families receive support, they receive cash. When they come back, they receive hefty payments to the tune of $500 to $1,000 a month. Now, this is someone who's never had a job. He has no economic prospects. But all of a sudden, this person comes and tells him, if you're going to do this, I'm going to pay you that. And you can already see the results.
I see. Mustafa, he mentions a very crucial point there of corruption. Let's talk about the government reactions. Let's begin with Nigeria. It's been several years now. How would you describe the reaction of government?
You know, I'm glad my brother brought up this issue of corruption. He's absolutely 100% right. In the Nigerian case, right now, as I speak to you, there's a group of Nigerians who are threatening to take both the military in particular and the government court and ask them, first of all, to stop giving protection to some politicians while the masses are unprotected. That's one. Two, the spiritual leader of all Nigeria's Muslims, the Sultan of Sokoto, made a very interesting remark just last week. He said, every time there's a need for the legislature to debate budgets for the military, you see a rise in militant attacks by Boko Haram. You know there have been many allegations, although unsubstantiated up to now, that the Nigerian government may either be indirectly supporting or there are elements within the Nigerian government. In fact, the Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan himself, made such an assertion once that there are Boko Haram elements within his own government. Also, the Nigerian soldiers themselves have been complaining bitterly about the fact that their seniors have been taking away all the money that has been budgeted for security purposes in the country. Many people question why it is taking 4 or 5 years for the Nigerian government, which is very well known for its activism in, you know, bringing to an end such militancy in other countries, for them to be able to quash this nonsense that has been taking place in Nigeria. And everybody reaches one conclusion: corruption is the reason why this is happening. And so the issue my brother brought up is very legitimate, and this is why it is taking so long. You know, the budget for the military is actually the largest in most countries because defense is the key, you know, to the stability of most of these nations, particularly in the African continent. There hasn't been much in terms of reaction from the government in Nigeria except to, you know, offer very weak responses to these allegations of corruption. But we know corruption is endemic in Nigeria and many other African countries. It is probably why if traditional rulers and religious leaders like the Sultan, who is a former military general, would actually come out openly And make such a statement, you know, it is becoming close to a fact. You know, so the issue there, it is on the ground. The question is, what are people going to do about it? Recently, some traditional rulers in Nigeria have been coming out publicly to ask people to form vigilante groups and defend themselves. You know, because the military seems unable to tackle this issue, mainly because of there's so much money. In fact, there have been so many allegations of generals owning mansions in Abuja. I don't know if you know how expensive it is to own even a two-bedroom in Abuja. And these people own mansions, you know, in some choicy areas of the capital. So corruption is a fact.
Let me go to Kisumu. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has replaced his interior minister and police chief. This as a result of following the massacre of some people by this Islamic group, Al-Shabaab. Do you think, back to our point of corruption and in forces being unable or unwilling to contain these groups, did this play a role in these changes?
These changes, they might work to some extent, because the security services in Kenya, as much as they may be corrupt at the grassroots level, they tend to be a very top-down and top-heavy. They work with a very top-heavy kind of system. So during the era when we had the former police chief known as Major General Hussein Ali, he was a very, 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 very tough-talking person who would take action, and he reported directly to the president. And when he vowed that there would not be a particular kind of criminal menace somewhere, he would actually spend sleepless nights until he achieved it. And the person who's been appointed to that post right now, the interior ministry now, not the police chief, is a person called Joseph Nkaiseri, a former military person who joined politics in the election of 2002. Now, Nkaiseri also happens to be a very no-nonsense guy. He was a major general by the time he left the military in 2002. And he might push these things to some extent. But the question is, for how long will you work with these half measures? Mm-hmm. It makes sense to ensure that this discipline is there and it is not based on personalities, but is actually a system that works. That is the problem that we are facing, Douglas, right?
I see. Aliyu, in Kenya, at least there's some effort by the president to fire some people responsible and try to, at least to appear to be doing something. People have accused, some analysts have accused the government in Abuja of being laid back. They don't seem to be acting like this.
You know, back downstairs in our newsroom, when we read that Kenyatta Uhuru sacked his interior minister and his chief of police, this comes just about barely a week or just about 10 days after the Nigerian police had gone to the National Assembly and tear gassed national lawmakers.
Right.
And just last week, the Nigeria's Inspector General of Police went to the National Assembly in response to an invitation by the legislature to answer to the charge of gassing the lawmakers. And the most interesting aspect of his appearance was that he refused to recognize the speaker. He would not name the speaker as the speaker. He named him by his personal name, Aminu Waziri Tambuwal. And no matter what the legislators did, he wouldn't recognize. He said because the speaker, you know, decamped from the ruling PDP to the opposition party, that as far as he, the Inspector General of Police, is concerned, the speaker is no longer the speaker. You know, the speaker was, first of all, a representative of his constituency. He was chosen by the members of the House of Representatives. Even the president calls him the speaker. For the police to have taken sides in a political fight, the police should have no business whatsoever about the speaker switching parties. Their duty is to protect everybody, including the members of the National Assembly. So when this happened in Kenya, and not only in Kenya, everybody was remembering that in Nigeria, nobody has ever been dismissed or fired or sacked by the current Nigerian government for whatever role they may have played in this insurgency. That's one. You also remember that there have been this allegation for a very long, long time of people doing things that should warrant them being fired in Nigeria, and they're not getting fired. You remember also in Mexico, 43 students or young people were kidnapped, And that led to the other resignation or firing of many officials, including the mayor of a particular town. We still have these 300 or so girls that have been kidnapped in Nigeria who have not been found. And to date, nobody has been punished for it at all. Nobody has even been accused of being responsible for their safety. First of all, they were kidnapped. And second of all, none of them have been found. And up to date, nobody has been held accountable for this. This laxity is really not helping matters much in Nigeria or even in the eyes of the world, you know. So what Kenya did is a shining example of what should be done. Somebody must be held responsible and accountable in situations like this where people are found to not have done their jobs.
I see. Well, gentlemen, Fred, hold your thought. Let's take a short break. We'll be back to continue our discussion of Islamist extremist attacks in Nigeria and Kenya. And when we come back, we'll look at major causes of these extremist groups.
African Music Mix.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. North to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Tune in from 0 to 300 hours UTC and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC every single day on the Voice of America.
Welcome back. In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we're coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. Our topic tonight is Islamic extremist attacks in Nigeria and Kenya. Our panelists are my colleague, Ali Mustafa. I'm sorry, earlier on I mangled your name. I twisted it upside down.
Right.
But Ali Mustafa of VOA House of Service. And Fred Omolo of the Kenyan newspaper, The Standard. And I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, here in Studio 9 in Washington. Aliyu, unlike in Kenya where Al-Shabaab actually held territory or still holds some territory in Somalia, a neighboring country, in Nigeria, Boko Haram is holding territory, the so-called caliphate, in some parts of Nigeria. And Nigeria is going to an election soon. How does that one work?
Well, let's look at the territory itself, because that is key. Borno State, where Boko Haram began, is a state that is bordering three international borders, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger Republic. Nearby is Yobe State, and very close to that is Adamawa State. These are all in the northeastern part of Nigeria. As we speak right now, recently there have been some gains by the military in bringing down, wresting power from the Boko Haram. They call this place Caliphate. They have even changed the name of some of the cities. There's one they call Medina something, which used to be something else. Like I said, Douglas, the uniqueness of the situation in Nigeria, in northeastern part of Nigeria, is the majority of the residents of these parts are Muslims already. So the argument that Boko Haram is trying to Islamize that part of Nigeria is nonsense, because they're already Muslims. So if they're already Muslims, I don't know what else you want them to do. They're doing everything that Islam entails. The other part of Nigeria, which is the south, is the non-Muslim part of Nigeria, and that is the most peaceful part of the country as of now. Those parts also where the Boko Haram is active are also very economically, at least they used to be, economically very active places, you know, with lots of trading, border commercial activities, economic, very many economic activities taking place there. So Boko Haram doesn't seem to be interested in the economic aspect of it. It just seems to be interested in the ideological aspect of this. They want to be able to control this part. But what nobody seems to understand is why. What is it that they want to do that is not already happening? If you talk about Sharia, they are already Sharia state, because they are already Islamic state. And already you remember that Sharia has already been institutionalized in those parts of the country many, many years ago, even during before Jonathan's emergence as the president of this country. So we are still in total darkness as to what it is that Boko Haram is trying to do, except some people argue that they are trying to bring down the government by by fighting, by militancy, by insurgency, and all of that, which differs, which is probably the only common link between them and Al-Shabaab in this case,
yes,
the effort to bring down the government. But if you're trying to bring down the government, do you do it in just one section of the country and for so long, and they keep going back and forth from one area to another? So it doesn't seem to be making a whole bunch of sense.
Yes, Afred, have you taken care of that dog yet? Well, back to our topic. Let's now look at how are these groups, both Boko Haram, and I want to find out from both of you whether there's a difference here. How are they able to attract and recruit people? Let's begin with you in Kenya there. How are they able to convince these young men to die for their cause, so to speak?
Okay, as first of all, as I've mentioned previously, they tend to work with a cash incentive. They take unemployed and hopeless youth. And this is pretty much the same formula that Al-Qaeda was using when it was recruiting in the Middle East, if you remember, in the late 90s and the early 2000s. So that has not changed. It still works the same way. But they also have what you can call sleeper cells, as well as benefactors within Kenya. Now, this has been very, very explicit in places like Mombasa, right? You have these young groups who've been taking over mosques, kicking out moderate and neutral imams and killing some of them. And a lot of this has just been happening in front of the very eyes of the police and the law enforcement agencies. And from these mosques, they have these fiery preachers who are Kenyans, who are ready to chip in ideologically for their cause. And these are the guys who funnel these youth from different parts of the country, from different ethnic communities. These days you have, I'm Luo, for example, and I live in Kisumu, which is majority Luo. And next to us, we have Kisis, we have Luyas. And in places like Nairobi, you have a large population of Kikuyus. But you find that some of these Al-Shabaab recruits who go out into Somalia through that funnel system that passes through Mombasa, you find that they come from all ethnic communities, and the common denominator is that all of them are from hardship backgrounds. They don't have jobs. They have basically hopeless prospects for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination between looking for youth who feel hopeless on the one hand, then work with the benefactors. And a lot of the richer members of the extremist Islam also fund these activities, and then these people are pushed into Somalia, and they go there and they train in the few camps that are left there. By the way, we need to understand that the Al-Shabaab we are talking about today is not really the same Al-Shabaab that it was in 2011 and 2010, for example. Right now, they're actually very weakened. Many of the attacks that they're conducting now are purely down for nuisance value.
Mm-hmm.
To derive relevance, to push a cause that they weren't really fighting for Kenya being in Somalia in 2010 or 2011, but they were still coming here and conducting attacks and issues of that nature. So now, in the reverse system, once the youth have been trained in Somalia, they start coming back into Kenya, and they use now the corruption networks. And this is how they bring in weapons, this is how they bring in militants, and then they funnel out into, they spread out into different parts of the country, and they conduct these attacks.
Mm-hmm.
However, over the last month, we've had two serious attacks in which 60 people have died, 28 in the first and 36 in the second attack. And in both cases, witnesses say that the militants who came and killed those people were in fact almost entirely Somalians, Somalian Al-Shabaab members, right? So even though these youths are still being trained, once they're in a position to have that little economic satisfaction that they were looking for, some of them desert, some of them come back and hide in their communities where they cannot be reached by these militants. So that is the funny situation we have out here.
Okay, Ali, I want you to address a similar question about the recruitment and the financing of Boko Haram.
There isn't much evidence, but it is very clear that Boko Haram has been extremely ingenious sort of in finding support within and outside of Nigeria. One of the open evidence that people have for their funding, obviously robberies. You know, when they go into town, their first targets usually are the banks. They open these bank vaults and they take whatever they can find. And if you raid as many as 2-3 banks in a day, obviously you're going to come into a large amount of money. So they use robberies. They also use kidnappings, you know, and they demand ransom. Sometimes they kidnap foreigners, and sometimes you hear this sudden release of these foreigners, and nobody explains the background or the circumstances under which they are released. And it is believed that in most cases, these people are paid, and they are paid big way, big money, running into millions of naira or dollars, who knows. In addition to that, it is believed that they get domestic support within the country. Nobody has come forward to say this is who is supporting them, but their ability to first of all get these big tanks, military tanks, sometimes they appear much better armed than the Nigerian military. You see all these French tanks behind them when Abubakar Shekau appears in one of his videos, you know. You see all these large things, and there have been reports of even helicopters, you know, flying them from one place to another. There are also reports that they may be getting some additional aid from the Al-Qaeda and the Maghrib, you know, organizations, you know, and groups that have similar goals with them. Lately, you may have noted that they've been using females a lot, young ladies, and some people believe they may be some of the girls that they had kidnapped from Chibok. And so they send out these young men and women, and they also rob banks, they rob people. They do. They stop cars in the middle of the street or in the on the highways, and they rob people of their property. So there have been many sources of funding for these people. But whatever it is that is going on, it has to be that these people have ability to raise large amounts of cash to be able to support their activities.
Okay, in a word or two, because we're running out of time, Boko Haram doesn't seem to be weakening. It seems to be growing stronger.
Within the last 2 weeks, they've been suffering a lot of defeat in the hands of the military, which is good news. Also, you have to understand that people are no longer sitting down waiting for them to come in and attack them. People are taking arms. There have been groups of traditional hunters, young men and women forming vigilante groups. It started in Maiduguri, and they've been fighting back. Because most of these Boko Haram people are people that other people know.
Yeah, there are people in the community.
Yeah, in the community. So they are known. I mean, they know. Some people went to school with them. Some people worked with them. And they have people from all kinds of backgrounds. You know?
Yeah, in 10 seconds, Fred, you mentioned earlier on Al-Shabaab is weakening. But are they still very dangerous? Are they still capable of causing havoc? Just in about 10 seconds.
Yes, Al-Shabaab is capable of causing havoc if the current state of the Kenyan security services remains the same. But if there is a change, there is more vigilance, there is less corruption, there is more seriousness about dealing with this threat, about dealing with this menace, then the decline is going to continue, and in no time there will be there won't be anything to talk about or mention.
Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our panel. My colleague Aliyu Mustafa of VOA Hausa Service and Fred Omulo of the Kenya newspaper The Standard. Gentlemen, thank you
for being
with the show.
Thank you, Douglas.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Our producer has been Jackson Mufunganya, and our engineer tonight was Michael Dubinsky. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that in case you missed any part of this program or just like to hear it again, you can access it by going to our main website at www.voanews.com. Click on Programs and scroll down to Reporters Roundtable, and you can listen to the whole program again. Once again, thanks very much for tuning in, and until next week, I'm your host Douglas Impuga in Washington, wishing you all the best.